You're listening to Read On Air, recorded on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. Now, it's time to go husband hunting with Anda Corsi. She talked to Red Sail.
Anda Corsi, welcome to Read On Air.
Hello, Red. It's very nice to be with you. My book came out 2 or 3 months ago. Its subtitle does quite a lot of explaining what it's about. It's The Husband Hunters, Social Climbing in London and New York.
It's a subject I knew a little bit about because I've always rather liked Evelyn Waugh novels, and American heiresses on the hunt for a broke baronet seem to pop up quite a lot there. Were there many of them coming over to England?
My book is actually set between 1870 and, I suppose, 1905, when a huge influx of American girls, about 100, married into the peerage. It was a kind of almost like a gold rush. Well, the gold was on their side. They brought it over. But an awful lot of them came over, and the real reason was because very often they were made to by their mothers, who were the real husband hunters, because their mothers wanted to get into New York society. And you couldn't get into New York society if you didn't know Mrs. Astor. And if Mrs. Astor didn't want to know you, she didn't know you. But she would never refuse to know the mother-in-law of a duke.
Oh, so it really was as acquisitive as that to get into the right salon.
It was absolutely like that. I mean, post-American Civil War, enormous fortunes were made in America because the South had to be reconstructed, railways had to be reconstructed, iron, metal, army supplied, all kinds of things. So there were a whole lot of hugely rich men, and they were married to women who were equally competitive, I suppose, but their only battlefield was the drawing room, the salon, and they wanted to get into New York society. And they fought and fought to do so, but they were regarded by old New York as very nouveau. They were called the bouncers, some of them. And very often their daughters were their weapons. If you had a beautiful daughter, she could marry up, as they say. And sometimes she married into an old American family, in which case you were all right. But other times she had to go farther afield, and that's what started the rush to Europe. And then after the Franco-German War, first they went to France, where they were welcomed at the court of the Empress Eugenie. As long as you were rich, beautiful, and beautifully dressed, you were very welcome there. But after the Franco-German War, they had to look further afield, and they managed to get an entree into England. And quite a bit of that was due to the Prince of Wales, who loved American women, as did a lot of people, because they had very special qualities.
And so they were welcome. Were many of the marriages successful?
Somewhere, the marriages that were successful were there were one or two that were actually for love, like Jenny Churchill and Lord Randolph Churchill, who proposed to her 3 days after he saw her. And they married. There was great opposition from both families at first, but they managed to marry. But an awful lot were not happy, because there you were, a beautiful, rich, young, fated American girl in your own country. And to leave your family, your friends, everybody you knew, to come over to a country that had fairly cold and damp, that hadn't heard of central heating, the plumbing was rather shaky, to say the least, and to live in a society with a husband who took over all your money, it all went straight into his pocket, and where you were treated, unlike in America, you were very much treated as the subsidiary, the second-class citizen. They were not used to that. They were no longer princesses. They were adjuncts. And it didn't always go down very well.
And I suppose a lot of them were living in rather tumble-down ancestral homes that needed a lot of money, or a lot of their money, to put right, which can't have been particularly luxurious for them.
Well, that's perfectly true. I mean, Consuelo Vanderbilt, when she married the Duke of Marlborough, the Marlboroughs were on the pitch, on the edge of being really broke. And even during the honeymoon, he was spending the enormous dowry she had brought with her. Well, I mean, the results you can see in Blenheim today, it's wonderful. But their dowries went straight into these places, and it's true, they kept a lot of these places absolutely going. Some of them, let's face it, took to it like a duck to water. May Galette, who married the Duke of Roxburgh. She was older, she knew her own mind, she was 25 as opposed to 20, so she'd seen quite a lot of the world. And she had made up her mind that really, with her looks and her money, nothing but a duke would do, but he would have to be a rather special duke. And the Duke of Roxburgh was very good-looking, very nice, had a wonderful place. She married him and was very happy. There were so many of them. There were actually advertisements in the papers from indigent peers or baronets seeking ladies with a fortune of no less than whatever it is. I will treat you in all respects properly. I will never disclose what happened, but the fortune must be whatever. You know, and one enterprising American journalist pretended she was an heiress and came over and put advertisements in the paper, and she got a flock of replies. And to her great surprise, when she actually went to interview some of these people, she said they were exactly what they said they were. but she didn't take any of them up. She wrote it up for her paper, but it was, you know, you would see advertisements in the Daily Telegraph for an American heiress.
I'm struck by the similarities in some ways to another one of your books, The Fishing Fleet, which describes how young women were sent out from Britain to India from the 1830s onward.
They really started actually from, I think, the early 1600s. It was a 300-year spell, and the first lot were sent out. This was the fishing fleet. The first lot were actually sent out because the East India Company, it was voyages then, took about 6 months and no real certainty you'd get there. They were terrible voyages, so that they didn't come back on leave. Men didn't come back on leave. And a lot of them married or had liaison with Indian women, but quite a lot wanted a British bride. And sometimes orphans of good family who'd got no money and no prospects in England would be sent out there. These girls were sent out, the early ones, and they were fed and clothed by the East India Company for a year. And during that year, the pretty ones, the nice ones, they were snapped up incredibly quickly. I mean, one who was widowed when her husband got cholera was actually proposed to as she came out of the funeral. They really were snapped up. But the ones who were too nasty or too plain or too awful even to find husbands in the depths of the province were sent back at the end of the year, and they were called returned empties, which is not very nice.
Very sad.
Yes.
And I know from talking to you last night that your new book is really quite exciting. It's The Life and Times of Coco Chanel.
Yes, it's going to be called Chanel's Riviera, and it's about the years 1930 to 1944. In 1930, Chanel put down roots on the Riviera in the shape of her first and only house. It was a sanctuary. It was called La Pausa, and she went there every year. You see, from 1934 onwards, she lived in the Ritz, she lived in an hotel. So it was her only real home. And the Riviera during the 30s, it was incredibly glamorous at first. And then, of course, all these shadows from the coming war. And then you get from June 1940, when the armistice was signed between France and Germany, then you get this terrible oppression of the Jews by Vichy France. And so I've been researching the stories of some of the ones who they came to the Riviera because they thought it would be safe, you see. And they came into these terrible difficulties. They weren't even allowed to earn a living. So I've been researching some of their stories. So you have the glitter, first of all, and then you have the very dark shadows, and then comes the liberation.
And she, of course, was a woman who came from nothing, died very rich, very successful, but again used her beguiling looks and personality to forward her ambition.
Absolutely, and her talent. I mean, that was the great thing. She had this genius, really. I mean, she was an innovator. She produced quite different clothes from before. That's what put her on the map. As opposed to the flounces, the frills, the endless goffering and pleating and ironing and ribbons and frills, she produced simple clothes that women could move in. They could if need be, in a Chanel suit, you can run for a bus quite happily. You could never have done it before. Sort of starkly elegant, but she softened those with wonderful ropes of beads, precious stones, semi-precious, fake. She didn't mind as long as they looked good. So it was a kind of luxurious simplicity, was, I suppose you'd say, her keynote, both when she did up houses. She did up not only her own house, but the Duke of Westminster's house. And in fact, she did up his house in Scotland. You may be interested to know that she introduced the first bidet to Scotland.
You do find out some wonderful facts in your research.
Yes.
Are you planning a trip to the Riviera whilst you write the book?
Oh, yes, I'm going to the Riviera. And I'm happy to say I've had countless offers of assistance if I wish to go.
Oh, somebody got in there before me, did they?
Yes.
Well, and of course, thank you so much.
Thank you, Red. It was a pleasure.
Thanks once again to Anne de Courcy, and she'll be back on a future show telling us the books of her life.